This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
When it comes crashing down and it hurts inside.
Hulk Hogan. There, I've said it.
You gotta take a stand, it don't have to hide.
Yes, the man of bottled hair and bottled tan, the pro wrestling champ whose face looks like it was pickled in steroids, who has probably made more off of his own sex tape accidentally than almost anyone in history, joins Larry Flint of Hustler as a champion of the First Amendment. Actually, he's a destroyer of the First Amendment. Talking about Hulk Hogan, kind of a milestone in my career, if I may veer into a zone of naive smugness. But the issue of Hogan's sex tape and a successful lawsuit against bottom-feeding news outlet Gawker, a lawsuit bankrolled by internet billionaire Peter Thiel, he founded PayPal, is a serious new twist for the Bill of Rights. Thiel, one of the earliest investors in Facebook, also has his own problems with the company that go way back. ValleyWag, a Gawker-owned site that's since been shuttered, published a story entitled Peter Thiel is Totally Gay. People, at that time, Thiel had not publicly spoken about his sexuality. He wasn't pleased. Still, his willingness to throw $10 million at Hulk Hogan's lawyers to bring down Gawker sends out a bigger message that those with the fattest wallets have the thinnest skins. Who can fill the role as defender of sites like Gawker from civil lawsuits that result in censorship or destroy such companies altogether? The Knight First Amendment Foundation, the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University would like to give it a shot. It's a $60 million effort to preserve and expand First Amendment rights. The Institute will support litigation in favor of protecting freedom of expression and the press. And Columbia President Lee C. Bollinger spent some time talking about his commitment to an issue that he says should concern everyone.
Well, the Gawker case has now taken on several dimensions. I mean, one part of it is there a right of privacy recognized within the First Amendment? Or should be recognized within the First Amendment. The second dimension of this Gawker case has to do with the funding of the litigation effort. And on that, I'm not one of those who is highly concerned about money being brought to litigation. I think this is a pervasive, long-standing sort of practice in the United States. The substance, the issue, how we should interpret free speech, free press in light of claims of invasion of privacy, that's what this case really highlights.
And does it bother you that Gawker and there are other kinds of media outlets on the internet who live off of playing the very edge of that kind of privacy sort of domain where they basically make their money off of titillating privacy-violating facts that are going to get onto their site and produce traffic? That's the business model.
So this is a very hard and complicated problem, John. I would say the following.
Well, you know what Jeff Bezos said today? He was asked about this today, like off the cuff. And he said, and he owns the Washington Post now, so he's a huge player.
Right.
He goes, well, if revenge is your goal, you're digging two graves, one for yourself and one for the person that you want to take revenge on, referring to Peter Thiel, who funded the Hulk Hogan lawsuit.
Right.
Then he went on to say that the only effective defense for a public person against things that are going to be said about you is to develop a thick skin, which is both support for Gawker and also a kind of grow up and everybody settle down kind of approach to the law here, which, you know, thick skin is not going to be a solution.
Let's start with the fact that in the United States, over the past 50 years, the country has decided through cases of the Supreme Court, and I think they've achieved a level of bipartisan support in the culture that's really quite impressive. I mean, there aren't many things that are really sort of basic values of the country that you can point to where there is a consensus across the ideological spectrum. But on this one, I think there is. And that proposition is that in order to have a really robust public discussion and a real self-government in the United States, a real democracy, we're going to have to accept that there will be a lot of speech that is deeply, deeply offensive, very harmful, and highly risky and dangerous in order to have the kind of discussions and speech that we want. I think the question today is, are we still committed to that general approach to free speech, free press in the United States? And I think we are and should be. And the second question is, do the new technologies of communication change the balance of values for us on that question? Should our rules, our doctrines, our principles be modified in some ways to take account of that shifting balance?
Do you think that the law has lagged behind technology in protecting whistleblowers and protecting people who come to disclose information because they believe that Americans need to know about it and that those individuals should be protected? Snowden, of course, is accused of treason.
So, John, you've hit on two of the most interesting and difficult problems, I think, that we need to face as a society, will face really over the next several decades. So on this one, every society has to decide where they are going to strike the balance between allowing the government to operate in some degree of secrecy and privacy and the interest of the public in knowing about what the government is doing. Those two values, those two interests have to be resolved in some way, and they're never going to be resolved completely one way or the other. So you have to design a kind of system for it. In our country, the balance was struck largely in Pentagon Papers, the famous case from the 1970s, and a few other peripheral decisions. The question today is whether the circumstances have now changed such that the balance should shift. So what are the different circumstances? Number one, Pentagon Papers involved several volumes of a history of the Vietnam War that Daniel Ellsberg, the government official, had to Xerox. Today, you can do hundreds of thousands of documents, really millions of documents, with the click of a button. So a lot more information can be taken from the government and handed over. Second major difference is that it's not the Washington Post and the New York Times that is getting this information and then deciding whether to publish all of it or some of it and listening to the government about what harms would happen from publication. It's Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, which are basically an anarchist kind of organization that have the belief that everything should be public, which I think no reasonable person would subscribe to. So the amount of information and the parties who are receiving that information and can make it public have now changed. And the question is, do we need a new balance? This is a major issue. And as I said, there's no question in my mind that this will reach the Supreme Court sometime in the next decade or two.
Lee C. Bollinger is Columbia University president and First Amendment scholar. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, John.
So many ways to express ourselves, many new threats. Can we rely on academics and lawyers to be the sentries and protectors of free speech? Wendy Kaminer is a lawyer, an author, and free speech advocate who's more than a little worried, and she joins us from our partner station, WGBH, in Boston. Welcome, Wendy.
Thank you.
How are you feeling about foundations giving money to institutions like Columbia University to protect the Bill of Rights? Everything's fine.
Everything isn't fine. I'm glad that the Knight Foundation is supporting a project on protecting free speech at Columbia. I hope only good will come of it. But everything is far from fine. President Bollinger questioned whether or not we still had a consensus on the value of free speech in America. I'm not sure we ever really did, but to the extent that we did, I think it has completely broken down. And I think that for a number of reasons, you can see it very clearly on college campuses. We have a movement going back 20 or 25 years now on campus to restrict whatever is considered offensive or demeaning or derogatory speech. We have rules coming out of the Obama administration that define harassment so broadly as to practically include any speech of a sexual nature that someone doesn't like or finds offensive. We have new technologies, incredible new technologies. And whenever you have technological revolutions, you have more anxiety about speech because technologies give more people more opportunities to spread their ideas much more widely. And we have never in history experienced anything like the kind of technological communications revolution that we're seeing today. And, of course, we also have the ever-present fear of terrorism, and we have ever-present surveillance, which has, I think, you know, a particularly corrosive and insidious effect because we are all virtually under surveillance all the time. If not under surveillance by the government, then under surveillance by corporations. And when people are under surveillance, they watch what they say. A couple of years ago, Penn did a survey of its own writers asking them about the effect of surveillance and found overwhelming concern about it and that writers were, in response, self-censoring.
Let me back up for a moment. I mean, the consensus that you talked about and that Lee Bollinger talked about, is that required for us to enforce this value of free speech? Above all, the framers didn't necessarily think that free speech was going to be something we voted on and that the consensus was going to determine. Isn't it the responsibility of the Supreme Court and the judiciary to hold fast regardless of what the ebbs and flows of consensus are?
No, it is the responsibility, obligation of the Supreme Court to interpret the Constitution, which Supreme Court justices naturally tend to do, at least in part, in response to what's going on in the culture. Supreme Court justices come out of our culture, and they respond to what's in the culture. But more than that, if we depend on litigation and academic theorizing to defend our rights of free speech, we will find them evaporating very quickly.
Wendy Kaminer, lawyer, author, and free speech advocate. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Ethan Denault from Tampa, Florida. I don't believe there should be any limits on what we say and publish, barring the already limited barriers created by the Supreme Court. But we should not expect that everyone should accept and celebrate how we express ourselves.
Acushnet, Massachusetts, we have a wave of social media hate and anger because it's easy and anonymous, but when it crosses a point and reasonable people can agree on both sides, then it needs to be pulled immediately and connected accounts blocked. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ or Curious quotient through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at Curious.com/PRI.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.